Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Thanks for joining us today. If you're new to the show, I hope you'll subscribe on iTunes or your favorite Android app, and let's get growing. Do you love to listen to audio as much as I do? Have you ever tried an audiobook? As a fan of this podcast, you must already enjoy listening to stories just like I do. Well, the Organic Gardener Podcast has teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook. Just go to www.organicgardenerpodcast.com/book or just type book into the search bar at theorganicgardenerpodcast.com and you can get entered to get listening to your first audiobook today.
Testing, testing, testing. Tom Neatman. Is Skype going to work? Why do I have no Wi-Fi up here? Can you hear me now? Okay.
Jackie, how are you?
I'm good.
Good. Everything all right on your end now?
Well, we'll see how it goes. I ended up using my phone as a hotspot because I don't know why I can't get on the Wi-Fi at school today. At first, I thought it was just Facebook wasn't working because they don't let you get on Facebook. It's supposed to only be from like 8 to 4. And then I realized...
I see.
Nothing's working. And so, I don't know, but we'll see if it seems you're clear.
Good. Yeah, I can hear you. You might fade out now and then, but we'll try and we'll see what happens.
Well, that tends to be like my fault for not speaking into my mic more.
Oh, okay.
It seems like we have a good connection.
To know.
So, okay, cool.
Good.
So, do you actually garden? Are we going to talk gardening questions or we're just going to talk about wine?
Well, my husband is the one who does the gardening. I do the cooking from the garden.
And we'll mostly
talk about wine and a little bit about recipes, I guess.
All right. Sounds good. My listeners always like different things and diverse things. Okay. The only thing I didn't get up. Sorry. I was so crazy trying to get that. Because then I even tried to find a different place to be. I just need to get a copy of the questions or just something to follow. Okay. Well, I'll just introduce you and we'll go from there.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. Here we go. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. I am just super excited to introduce my featured guest who has been very patient with my schedule. And we're talking early morning in August. And he's here from First Vine. And he's going to talk to us about wine today and cooking with wine and just some different things. So welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast, Tom Neatman. Is that how you say your name?
Thanks, Jack. Thanks so much. It's great to be on. I've been listening to a few of the podcasts trying to prepare for our talk. And it's been really fun. So I'm looking forward to talking to you.
Well, I'm going to give all the credit to my amazing guests, just like you. It is fun. So I just love podcasting. It gives me a way to meet other people who believe the same way I do. Because, you know, you walk out the door and you don't always find people like that. Like, even it seems like lately I've been having all these people telling me about using Miracle-Gro. And they're like, hey, I'm growing a garden. Aren't you excited? Or I'm working on my lawn. They think, you know, I'm going to be. And I'm like, okay, well, let's work on that. And then I'm back to school and there's the whole compost thing. And people have been like, you don't want to have compost in your classroom. Keep your classroom neat this year. No worm bin. And right away, you know, we have breakfast in the classroom. I'm like, what? I'm like, all right, I'll keep the worms in my apartment. I'll just take the compost home each night. But anyway, I'm in a fourth grade this year, so I'm pretty excited. The kids just jumped right on the composting thing. And, of course, since our garden's booming, Mike's been sending – yesterday I brought in the dragon tongue green beans, and we've had carrots, and I brought in like a dozen zucchinis the first day and passed them out to parents and teachers. And so the kids are enjoying that. So anyway, we're going to talk about you and not me. So why don't you tell listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a chemical engineer by training. And after college, I worked for a big food product development company. So my work history, at least initially, was about food, and I've always loved cooking. I had a little bit of knowledge about wine growing up. My dad came to the U.S. when he was 17 from Europe, and so he drank some wine and taught us a little bit about it. But he's also he was also more of a beer person when I was growing up. So it was kind of up to me to educate myself. I did that little by little over the years. And after graduate school, I ended up in DC and I was working for an environmental consulting firm and then switched to an environmental advocacy organization. And because of that, I got to meet people all over the world interested in the environment and environmental regulation. And I met a woman who was married to a man with a vineyard in Provence. And my husband and I went to visit them in 2002, and we'd got to taste wines we'd never had before because they don't make it to the United States. You know, I don't think people are aware just of how much wine gets produced all over the world. It's absolutely amazing. So in the Rhone Valley, which is in southeastern France, you have 6,000 vineyards in an area the size of the five boroughs of Manhattan. So if you think about that, you've got this huge concentration of wine. And so naturally, the majority of it isn't going to make it over here. And so we tried wines we'd never had before, and we're thinking, why can't we get these in the U.S.? And the idea, you know, percolated for a lot of years, but we finally figured out a way to get the wines over. And so we started with seven wines from four producers in 2007. And it was really, really fun to get that first shipment, you know, to see those pallets coming in. And then, of course, you know, then you've got to figure out a way to sell them, right? So that's been the tough part. I mean, the whole process of importing wine is, you know, is full of little administrative details that probably a lot of people would find really tedious, but I actually love it. I love that part of the job. And then I'm not a natural born salesman, so that's been the toughest part for me. But it allowed me to combine a lot of my education and my work background into doing something that was completely different. I had been doing environmental work for a long time, and as everybody's aware, you know, politics is kind of a cyclical thing. So you work hard to get something done, and then the administration changes, and they can, for the most part, take much of it away, not quite with a stroke of the pen, but by simply directing agencies not to enforce or not to direct any resources toward certain projects. And then once something's been taken away, it takes twice as long to get it back. So I thought that it might be time for me to get out of that kind of merry-go-round, because I'm kind of a bitter and cynical person by nature, and that was just making me more bitter and more cynical. There are aspects of the wine business that are not particularly nice, but by and large, nobody's in the wine business because they have to be. You know, they're in the wine business because they want to be. Whether it's the people who make the wine, they in many cases have been, their families have been making wine for generations. People who drink it, obviously, you know, they like it. But even, you know, the sort of the importer to the consumer chain, you know, it's filled with lots of nice people, and I've really enjoyed it so far. My background has allowed me to sort of delve into not only how wine gets made with the fermentation stuff, you know, which I had to study when I was an undergrad, but also, you know, sort of the theories behind the agriculture and how they relate to the kinds of foods that we eat and we know. You know, I import wines from France, Spain, and Italy, so their designation of organic is very slightly different from ours. They are also biodynamic wines, and then there are sustainable wines, and sort of teasing out what those really are has been a lot of fun for me. And I think that more and more as people are interested in how their food is produced, they're interested in how their wine's produced too. Probably 5 or 6 years ago, I'm not sure that people would have given it that much thought. You know, they'd go to the farmers markets here in DC and they'd buy some beautiful tomatoes. Then they'd shake the farmer's hand at the farmers market. And then they'd go home and, you know, pick a bottle of wine out of their for their wine rack and not really think so much about how that wine was produced. But now that's really changed a lot. Part of it for us here is that we have a big wine industry right next door in Virginia. So people can go and visit wineries and, you know, and see how things are made. Unfortunately, the laws in DC don't allow wineries to pour wine at farmers markets. You can't really get a permit to do that sort of thing, to sell wine and to pour it at farmers markets. I think that would be a great way for people to learn more too. So in the meantime, I'm blogging, I'm talking to people, I'm talking to my customers, and I'm trying to get them to understand that, you know, wine is an agricultural product. It doesn't occur to people first thing, but it is.
And isn't it like 27% of the chemicals that they put on agriculture in France are on wine, are on the grapes? Like in grapes, even in the U.S., Mike's always telling me, don't buy grapes. Grapes are covered in pesticides. Like they're some of the highest pesticide foods out there.
Well, yes and no. I mean, first of all, when we say pesticides, I think that people immediately think that pesticides are insecticides. Mm-hmm. But as you know, pesticides cover a whole range of chemicals. And most of the pesticides that get used on grapes, at least outside the United States, are fungicides. I'm sure you've seen those big, beautiful grapevines with their big, beautiful leaves. And if conditions are pretty wet, then, you know, if they don't dry out properly, if the grape growers don't get out there and separate the leaves so they don't stick together, you can very often get a lot of fungus growing, and they, you know, that could ruin the farmer's crop for the year. So in very limited circumstances, at least in France, you know, the growers are allowed to use a fungicide application, and it has to be, it's very closely regulated. If they don't use it, if they don't use the usually it's a copper sulfate product or something like that, they have to get out there and separate the leaves by hand if they've had bad weather. And you can imagine how difficult that is to do when you've got an enormous vineyard. So there is some fungicide use that continues so that farmers don't lose their crop. But by and large, they're not allowed to fertilize and they're not allowed to use insecticides. The idea is, and importantly too, they're not allowed to irrigate. You find that grapevines have these enormously long roots as they get older and older, because they're digging down and trying to find water. They're not allowed to irrigate, surface irrigate, or even drip irrigate in most cases. If they do that, yeah, if, you know,
is there a water shortage?
I'm sorry?
Is there a water shortage? Like, how come they're not allowed to irrigate?
Well, because they've determined that this makes better wine.
Oh.
So if the plants are stressed a little and the roots have to go way, way down into the soil, you get more soil contact with the roots. And they believe that that's what gives each little village in France its own particular character in the wine. This is what they refer to as terroir.
Yeah.
And you know that, I mean, I can taste enormous variation in wines, in similar wines that are made from the same grapes that are only 10 kilometers apart. And it has to do with the terrain and the soil and those grapevines getting these really, really long roots and going down into the soil to find water. It's not so, you know, there certainly are places in France where there's a water shortage, but typically the grapes are grown in soil that you would not grow anything else. You wouldn't be able to grow anything else in it. So, and it's been that way now for centuries. I mean, if you think way back, some of this agriculture technique was perfected by the Knights Templar, you know, back in the 12th century. So it really is a long-standing tradition. Most of it ended up getting codified in the early 20th century about what grapes would go into wines with particular names. And then also the agricultural practices got more codified after World War II. You know, there was certainly, well, World War I was extremely destructive to grapevines in France, but World War II was less so. But after World War II, they really started focusing on higher quality production and how to make sure that the you know, there was minimal chemical intervention, but still allowing the farmers to create their crops of grapes. You're right, though. There is still a lot of pesticide use, as I said, mostly fungicide in France. And yeah, the winemaking sector seems to account for, at least a couple of years ago, it was almost 20% of use of those chemicals. So they're trying to bring it down, and you know, they're experimenting with various ways to do that. It's been a tougher process for some of them. You know, it's it you in some cases you have centuries of tradition going on there. The
But
families
if
have
they
owned
have
the property for
centuries of
centuries, and
tradition, that's like way before, you know, they're using the stuff that we're worried about today, I think. You know, if they've been
well,
doing
I think
it,
that's
right?
true, but they well, they've always, you know, we've known about the, you know, antifungal properties of certain compounds for many, 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 many decades. And even, you know, back into the 19th century at least, you know, they knew about copper sulfate and some of the other chemicals that that they started using on grapevines at that point. But you're right. Yeah, I mean, they would certainly have planted them differently. You know, part of the issue now with as with most big agriculture is, you know, the density of planting encourages all kinds of growth, undesirable growth, and that applies somewhat to grapes as well. I mean, you see them trellised the way that they are, you know, to keep the vines off the ground. You see a lot of techniques that you wouldn't have had in the 19th century, certainly. I have a friend who is an agronomist who's actually studying the transition between the old way of planting grapevines, which
Cool.
was just in clusters, you know, leave the grapevine to keep growing. They were planted relatively far apart, as opposed to what we think of as the modern way, which is these, you know, these poles and the metal wires that go between the poles, and then the vines are attached to those trellises. And it seems that because Spain is making that kind of a transition now, it is having an effect on migratory birds. So you know, there's all sorts of stuff that we don't even consider when you're talking about changing the way you grow grapes for wine.
Let's hear more about like, how do you find your vendors? How do you go to Spain and be like, I want to get your wine? Like, how does that all work?
Well, I'm lucky enough to know people who live in various places in countries where I enjoy the wine, and they do a little scouting for me. I think everybody has this picture of my life as a wine importer that I arrive, I go get in a car, I drive on a little dirt road to visit some winery where you've got a battered sign and the winemaker comes out in his beret carrying a baguette and inviting me in. And it doesn't really work that way.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Well, no. So first I get recommendations for friends. But then, you know, the producers themselves organize wine shows where, you know, they invite importers to come and taste. And so I've been lucky to go to a number of those. And then, you know, even if you find something you like and you think that the price is right, it may or may not work out for importing. But by and large, you know, at least the latest producers that I've acquired have been at wine shows. And, you know, my friends who live in France and Spain are still on the lookout for me. So when they visit some place that's pretty good and the wine isn't available in the United States, they'll let me know about it. And, you know, it might take a few years before I'm either able to taste it or decide that I want to bring it over here. But, you know, it sort of works that way for me. There is luck involved, definitely, but there's also a lot of scouting that goes on.
Do you want to tell us about like wines? Like, so I am kind of I drink a lot of wine, but I'm not like a, you know, like my brother probably knows a lot more about different kinds of wines and things. And like, you know, which ones are fruity and which ones are sweet and which ones I kind of tend towards drier wines. I don't really like sweeter wines. Like, do you want to talk about like different flavored wines at all?
Sure. The thing to remember is I think people get nervous because they think they're going to be judged based on what they like. And if you like it, it's good wine. I mean, that's the first rule that everybody has to remember. Now, as far as how they taste and their sweetness level, it really varies all over the map. And this is what makes it confusing. You have a couple of things going on. First of all, in the United States, we're used to wine being named for the grape that it contains. So the rules are that if it's at least 75% that grape, then you can call it by that name and you don't have to say what other grapes might be used. So, you know, you say, I like Cabernet Sauvignon. I want a Cabernet Sauvignon. So then you have the issue of also where it's grown. The hotter the climate is in general, the more intense the wine is going to be. So once you know where it's grown and sort of, you know, like, in Europe, as you get further and further south, the wines get more and more robust. So if you're looking at wines from southern Italy, as opposed to northern Italy, the southern Italian wines are going to be just more robust. In general, they're going to be fruitier. As far as dryness goes, it has to do with how they make the wine. So you have the sugar content in the wine, the sugar gets turned into alcohol. And they can stop the fermentation before all the sugar is gone. Then you're going to have some residual sweetness to it. The more sugar in the grape, in general, the more alcohol that wine is going to have. So farmers have to decide when to pick their grapes based on the sugar content, because if it gets too high, they might not be able to ferment all the alcohol or all the sugar into alcohol. So those are considerations. But by and large, it really depends on what you like. I mean, there are certain truisms about wine in general. U.S. wines tend to be fruitier than wines from Europe.
They
And
do.
it's a, they do. And it's a question of preference, first of all, and also somewhat farming technique. So let's take Zinfandel, for example, in California. Zinfandel is the same grape as Primitivo in Italy. But Primitivo tastes different from Zinfandel because of the growing conditions and because, in general, European styles of wine tend to be a little less fruity and a little earthier tasting.
This is
So,
fascinating. This is totally fascinating. Sorry to interrupt.
no worries. So, and it's really a question of preference, and it's a question of tradition for them. Also, I think you'll find that in the U.S., we don't have the same way of growing grapes. I mean, you look in the Napa and Sonoma valleys, and the soil is beautiful. You could grow almost anything there. They choose to grow wine because the terrain is great for growing wine. But when you have really, really good soil, the roots don't have to go down as far into it to get nutrition. And that means that you don't get quite as much of the earthiness inside the grape, which then means your wine isn't going to be as earthy tasting. Now, there are some places, as I said, we're taking the example of Zinfandel. So you get some Zinfandel where, they might do a little irrigation, or they might have wonderful soil. So you get a really fruity taste to your Zinfandel. Doesn't mean that it's going to be sweet, although I do think that when a wine is really fruity, we have a perception of sweetness, even if it isn't actually sweet. So it might taste a little sweet. It might taste a little bit jammy. That's sometimes a word you hear used to describe Zinfandel. But then, if you go east toward the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains, you have terrain conditions that are more like some of the wine regions in Europe. And a lot of the farmers in the foothills there, they don't use any irrigation. They do complete dry farming. And you find that those wines taste a little bit more like wines from Europe. So, it depends on where you grow and how you grow. The hotter it is, as I said, the fruitier it could be. But Sicilian wine and wines from southern Italy, because of the climate, they're fruitier than wines from northern Italy. Same thing in France. When you have wines from Provence, where it's sunny and hot, they taste a little fruitier than the wines that you'd find in the Loire Valley, which is, a few hundred miles to the north. So all of that's important. But what you can do, certainly once you identify what you like, as far as the flavors that you like in wine and the level of dryness that you like in wine, you should be able to go into any reasonably good wine shop and tell them what you want, and they should be able to find you something that fits the flavor and the sweetness that you're looking for. I think that, though, I do want to say that I think that sweetness in wine has gotten a bad rap. And I think that's mostly because of white Zinfandel that sweetness has gotten a bad rap in wine. So white Zinfandel is an interesting thing. White Zinfandel is actually made with red Zinfandel grapes. So Zinfandel got planted, overplanted in the 60s and 70s. And so they had all this fruit, and they wanted to make something different out of it. So, as I said, the sugar level in the grapes determines how much alcohol it's going to have or how sweet it's going to be. So, when you have only minimal contact with the skins of the grape, you don't get color in the wine. All of the color in a red grape comes from the skin. If you peel it and look at it, the inside of the grape is green, kind of like a white grape is green on the inside. And the color comes from the skin. So if when you crush the grapes, you don't allow the grape skin to have much contact with the juice, you're not going to get that color. So they ended up with a light pink sort of wine. But also in the grape skin are all these other flavor compounds. And without those flavor compounds from the red skin, you can really taste the alcohol. So they were trying to get, they were starting to get these light colored wines that, you know, pretty much made you breathe fire when you drank them. So in order to avoid that, they would stop the fermentation before all the sugar was gone. So you'd end up with residual sugar, and that's why white Zinfandel tastes sweet.
Oh.
And so I think that's given sweet wines a bad name, because a little bit of residual sugar in wine sometimes actually makes them go better with food. So I find that, you know, spicy foods particularly go well with wines that have just a little bit of residual sweetness to them. So there are some lovely, lovely, just barely sweet wines that are made, particularly with grapes like Riesling. You find Riesling, Pinot Blanc. There's some great Oregon Rieslings, for example, and then Rieslings from New York State that go really, really well with a bunch of different foods. And taste those as opposed to, they don't taste cloyingly sweet. They just have a little bit of sweetness to them. But that's balanced by good acidity and good fruit flavor. And so when it's well balanced like that, a lightly sweet wine can be really, really good. So offline, I'll give you some recommendations to try if you have the chance. And I think I can convert you to a little bit of residual sweetness anyway.
Okay. Do you want to talk about what, I just have to ask, like, so they don't put the skin in the wine, but they should, or some people do, or like.
Yeah, well, I mean, red wine, you're always going to have contact with the grape skin. So the grapes come into the winery, and then they get crushed. They can get crushed gently. They can get crushed less gently. And so the more gently the grapes get crushed, the less that the skins are going to rupture. And then if they drain the juice off right away, the grapes have had minimal contact with the skin. So that's how you end up with rosés, with pink wines. Rosés are made almost exclusively from red wine grapes. So you don't, what, you know, a rosé tastes more like a white wine, but still has some of the flavors of red wine. So, for example, you could taste a rosé that has kind of a strawberry cherry flavor to it. You're never going to get those kind of flavors out of a white grape. They just don't happen in white grapes. So they come in red grapes. And so a little bit of the skin contact gives you those light fruit flavors. And then, you know, for fuller-bodied red wines, you know, the grapes can stay in contact with the skin for weeks before the juice is drained off. So it's really, really a question of what you're going to make. With white grapes, the skins don't add color to the wine, so they can stay on the, you know, they can stay in contact with the juice for longer. And so really full-bodied white wines, chances are they've had a lot of skin contact. It really depends on what you're trying to make and how you want it to look and taste. So the more skin contact, you know, the more not only the fruit flavors you're going to get, but then you're also going to get the compounds called tannins that are, you know, add a little bit of bitter notes to the wine. And tannins are also the things that help wines age in the bottle. So you can get tannins from the grape skin. You can get tannins from the stems of the grapes and from the seeds, too, depending on if you need to increase the tannin levels in the grapes. A lot of people don't like red wines because of the perceived bitterness of them. But that's part of the deal. And you can, you know, expose the wine to air, open the bottle a little earlier than you're going to drink it, and oxygen softens the tannins up and makes the wine smoother to drink. The other thing is to eat it with, you know, eat protein with the wine. So milk proteins like cheese, in cheese, they smooth out the tannins because they bind to the tannins and make them less bitter tasting. Meat proteins do the same thing. So, you know, you find that this is one of the reasons why they say, you know, red wine with meat, because the meat proteins soften up the tannins. The other thing that you have to consider is that when you're eating food with wine is the relative intensity of each one. I have friends who are going to drink big red wines with any food, no matter what. So whether it's, you know, mild tasting fish, or whether it's, you know, a big hearty steak, grilled steak with chimichurri sauce or something like that, they're going to drink big red wines because they just like the flavor. But in general, you don't want the wine to be stronger than your food, and you don't want the food to be stronger than the wine. So you have to look at it that way too. But pairing the wine and the food is a whole other discussion that we can have a little bit later. I just wanted to say that the compounds in the grape skin are some of the things that determine what foods are going to go with your wine.
Well, do you want to talk about food and wine now? Didn't you say you had some recipes for us or something?
Yeah, well, I've got a few recipes. I've been posting recipes and wine pairings on my blog now for like 8 years. And so I went back to look through for ones that I thought would be particularly interesting for people who grow their own food.
Cool.
The first one, so this is one I developed over the years, and it's spaghetti with fresh tomatoes and cucumbers. And I submitted it to the Washington Post tomato recipe contest a couple of years ago, and it was a finalist in the contest. So I was really excited about that. And you want to get the ripest tomatoes that you can get your hands on. I mean, ones that you would probably think, okay, if I let these go a couple of days, I'm going to have to cut off parts of them and throw them away.
Nice.
That stage of ripeness. So
we all have those, right? All of a sudden they're about to come on, and the next thing you know, you're inundated with overripe tomatoes that you don't know what to do with all. So awesome.
So core them, cut them in half through the equator, and then, you know, get a big bowl and pick up that half tomato and squeeze it gently over the bowl. Get out the, you know, as much of the seeds and the kind of the gel sort of stuff that the seeds are in, as you can. Use a spoon if you want. Then chop up the remaining tomato shells and throw them in there. So you take probably 3 large tomatoes for a pound of spaghetti, and then take 2 medium-sized cucumbers. If you've grown them yourself, you don't have to take the skin off. Obviously, if you get them at the grocery store, you probably want to take the skin off. You do want to quarter them lengthwise and take the seeds out, because they just add too much liquid to the dish. Cut them into 3/4 inch, those quarters into 3/4 inch slices. Throw them in there too. And then at this point, it depends on how your tomatoes taste. If they are not as sweet as you'd like them to be, add like a teaspoon and a half of balsamic vinegar to that, and some salt, some pepper, a little bit of red pepper flakes. I like to put a little onion in there, so you could use, you know, like say a half a cup of chopped scallions if you have them. half a cup of finely chopped red onion would be good too. Finely mince a couple of cloves of garlic and throw them in there. And as I said, salt and pepper. And you let that sit for an hour. So during that time, you're gonna, of course, there's gonna be a bunch of liquid that comes out of all, excuse me, all the vegetables. And then you bring your big pot of water to boil, add a pound of spaghetti. This seems to work best for spaghetti, I think. Cook it, save a little bit of the pasta water just in case you need it. excuse me.
That's all
Throw
right. You can
the
get a drink if you want.
tosses.
You know, I never told
Okay.
you. Usually when I if you know, if you need to let the dog out or get someone a cup of coffee or you know, if you need to put me on hold, it's no big deal because it's really easy to edit. Go ahead. If you want
Oh,
to get
okay,
take a drink,
great.
take a break.
All right,
Because you've been
give me
talking
just a
a
second,
lot.
and I'll give.
Yeah.
So you toss your cooked spaghetti right in that in that bowl with everything else, and you've saved a little bit of pasta water. So if it needs water, add a little bit. You probably won't need water though, because those vegetables really, they get a lot of liquid out of them by sitting there. And then you add some Parmesan or Romano cheese to that, toss it all up, taste it, see if you need more salt, pepper. You might need a splash more vinegar, either red wine vinegar or balsamic vinegar to it, and then just serve it. It's really amazingly good. If you have fresh basil, go ahead and put some fresh basil on there. I like to do each serving rather than toss it into the bowl because I think it just tastes a little better that way. But you can toss it in the bowl with the spaghetti too. A little bit of fresh oregano is good with that as well. So if you have it, ours grows like crazy, so we always have
No
it.
kidding.
And so, but I think you have to be careful with fresh oregano. It can be really, really strong. You don't want it to be too strong. So for a recipe like that, you're going to want something, a wine that has a little bit of acidity to it, because you want something really bright to go with your food. So Sauvignon Blanc is usually a good choice for something like that. There's a Spanish varietal of grape called Verdejo. If you can find Verdejo, that makes a great pairing.
How do you spell
Most
that?
summer rosés,
Sorry.
yeah,
How do you spell Verdejo?
Verdejo.
Okay, sorry. And then what was the other one?
Sauvignon Blanc.
But then wasn't there one at the end too?
Oh, I was just telling. I was saying, in the summertime, many rose. You could also serve a rosé with it. It's rosés vary in levels of acidity. So if you find one that has, just a little bit of a tang to it when you drink it, then that would be better to have. I think rosés look great on the table. So I'm always encouraging people to drink them even in the winter time. People think of them as summer wines, but my producers drink rosé all year long. Because it does a lot of good things. And in fact, I serve rosé with Thanksgiving dinner because I think it goes with everything on the table.
All right. Well,
So
that's good because there's a good chance we're going to be posting this right about Thanksgiving
Oh, great.
for the holidays. It's going to be somewhere between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So I think listeners will like that. What a recipe! I have never had cucumbers and spaghetti, except for when I mix my salad with my spaghetti, which I almost always do.
Well, and then the other thing about that recipe is that you may end up with some liquid in the bowl at the end, and you can just drink that like gazpacho. So
Or dip it up with some good yummy bread. You could see
absolutely.
me soaking some bread. Wow, well, that sounds awesome. I love that. Okay, well, did you have another recipe or?
Sure. Something that I like to do with tomatoes and eggplant,
Awesome. People are always asking about what to do with eggplant.
Well, so, you know, the big deal about eggplant is, do you have to salt it or not salt it, right? To get the bitterness out. And the only way you're going to figure that out is to cut it up and taste some of it. I mean, if it tastes really bitter to you, then you will need to salt it. But if it doesn't taste bitter, then you probably don't need to. And you may think it's kind of funny eating a piece of raw eggplant, because obviously it's not going to taste the way it tastes when it's cooked. But really, that's the only way I can tell if it's going to be bitter or not. Chances are, if you stick to the smaller ones, they're not going to be as bitter.
I was going to say, see, I don't have but I do. I like smaller vegetables, zucchinis, eggplants. I like to pick them when they're pretty tiny.
Yeah.
Like the size of a quarter. Eggplants maybe a little bit bigger.
Yeah. Well, if you're going for eggplants that size, you're not going to have any problem with bitterness. And so you don't need to salt them. But I find that the best thing to do with eggplant is either roast it or grill it. I think it just tastes better. Mm-hmm. So what I like to do is go ahead and, you know, if you've got one of those nonstick mats for baking sheets, use it. Parchment paper also works well. Or you just have to put a fair amount of oil on the baking sheet. But if you have parchment or the nonstick mat, I think it works a little bit better because, as you know, eggplants just soak up oil like crazy.
Yeah.
So the more that, you know, you can just keep putting oil on and they'll just keep absorbing it.
They
so
sure do.
If you want to use less oil, you know, the nonstick mat or the paper are the things that will help. And so brush them with a little oil, salt and pepper into a, you know, 400 degree oven, and 20 minutes, you're talking about slices that are about a half to three quarters of an inch. These will be done. So you take them out, and I like to make little stacks with sliced tomato, the eggplant, and then if you've got good fresh mozzarella cheese, that's great. If you don't have good mozzarella cheese, or you don't like mozzarella cheese, because not everybody does, you know, there are plenty of other cheeses that will work for this. You can use feta cheese. You can also use something that melts a little bit, like Swiss cheese. And you make little stacks. So eggplant, cheese, tomato, cheese, eggplant, cheese, tomato, just like that, stacked up on the baking sheet. Pop them back in the oven for a few minutes to melt everything. Drizzle them with a little oil, and out they come. And you can eat them. You can eat them right out of the oven. You can let them cool off a little bit and eat them slightly warm. Really delicious that way.
Oh, that does sound so good. And you know, I grew up in New York, but I live in Montana now. But you know, the mozzarella you get in New York is just, well, actually, I have a friend who lives up on a mountain with a cow, and she makes some homemade mozzarella that's to die for. But I was thinking ricotta cheese might be good with that too.
Yeah, it would.
A little harder to
the thing
eat,
with
maybe.
The ricotta, in order to keep it. Yeah, what you should do with the ricotta is put it in a, well, take a sieve and line it with damp paper towels. Put the ricotta in the sieve, set it over a bowl, and leave it in the refrigerator overnight. And you'll get about, if you're talking about, you know, something like a pound of ricotta cheese, you'll probably get a half a cup of liquid out of that. So you can save the liquid. Obviously, you don't throw that away. If you're baking bread, use the ricotta liquid in your bread. It's delicious. You could drink it just as it is. You can give it to your pets. Don't throw it away. But once the ricotta is drained, it will hold together a little bit better inside those, you know, in those stacks, and it won't ooze out when the heat hits it. So I like to drain it a little bit, especially if you've got some ricotta cheese, some supermarket ricotta cheese, and there are plenty of good brands of supermarket ricotta cheese. They just tend to have more liquid in them, and you know you want to get that liquid out.
So. I know my mom's always like, ricotta cheese is really expensive in Montana. It's like when I go to New York, I'm like, no way, I can't believe that's so cheap. Yeah, I can hardly ever afford it. I mean, it's just crazy. I don't know why. It's really expensive here.
Well, you know, the ricotta, well, if they make mozzarella cheese, they also make ricotta cheese because, you know, ricotta means recooked. And after mozzarella gets made, they take the whey from that's left over from the mozzarella and they, you know, they add either some sort of acid or rennet to it and they make ricotta cheese from that. So chances are if they're not making mozzarella first, then they're using, you know, milk and cream and making ricotta cheese that way, which is delicious, but it's a lot more expensive, you know. Mm-hmm. If you're using raw material that you've already used for something else, it's a lot less expensive to make. So I think that might be why.
Yeah. You know, I'm always surprised at how I live on the west side of the Rocky Mountains and I teach on the east side of the Rocky Mountains. And so when I'm over here, I'm always surprised at how expensive dairy products are. Their cheese is way more expensive. Their milk is way more expensive. And it seems so counterintuitive because there's a million cows over here. You know, we're out on the plains. There's farmland everywhere. I keep waiting for someone to open a dairy on the side.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder why they haven't. I mean, if people thought they could make a go of it financially, they'd probably have done it by now.
Yeah, but I don't know. It always just shocks me at how much more dairy is on this side of the Rocky Mountains than it is. I don't know. And it all pretty much comes from Spokane produce. I mean, you see the Spokane produce chart. I guess just because they have more gas. Maybe that's why.
Yeah, well, I mean, population density might have something to do with it, too. You know, I want to give you one more recipe tip, but then I want to make sure we talk about organic and biodynamic wines. So we were talking about zucchini earlier, and I find that I love to just grate zucchini up, salt it a little bit, get some of the water out of it, and then add that to all kinds of things. So when I make couscous, for example, I will go ahead and put grated zucchini, just saute it for for like a minute in olive oil and stir in your cooked couscous. It's really something. It adds a great flavor. Same thing with if you're serving rice with a meal, you don't even have to cook the zucchini then. If you've gotten some of the water out and you've got your grated zucchini there, just stir it into your hot rice and it, you know, adds a beautiful color, obviously, adds a lot of flavor. I think zucchini, you know, it can be a little bland, even the tiny ones. But once you've gotten some of the water content out of them, you really intensify the flavor. And I like to use it that way. I put it in scrambled eggs. You can put it in your, you can actually put it in your pancakes too. Just adds a little color. It doesn't make them taste like vegetables, but it definitely adds a nice kind of savory component to your sweet pancakes, which I think is really tasty.
I think you should open a restaurant.
I don't want to work that hard.
Were you going to tell us what wine goes with the mozzarella?
Yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt there.
Oh, no, absolutely. So, yeah, this is the time when you pull out the red wine, okay? And An eggplant goes very, very, very well with red wine. And of course, the mozzarella does too. So in this case, you want a fairly, a fairly robust red wine. I tend to serve French red wines with eggplant. So wines from the Rhone Valley in France, as you know, I was talking about the earthiness of wines. They tend to be a little bit earthier rather than fruity. You've got these sort of intense, meaty-ish flavors in the tomato. You have the earthiness of the eggplant. Eggplant just to me has a really earthy flavor to it. And then, the creaminess of the cheese and all of those kind of scream out for a bigger red wine to me. So if you can find Côte du Rhône wines and red wines around you, try one. Even the inexpensive ones, I think they're going to be perfect with something like that. If you're looking for a wine from California, one of the things I've been really happy to see about California wines is so it's it it used I mean there was like a 20-year period where all you could get was Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon out of California. But the people who first started making wine in California, at least in Northern California, most of them were Italian. They planted Italian varietals. So you can find California Sangiovese now. Sangiovese is Sangiovese. And they're making some really good Sangiovese in California. It's an Italian varietal. You find it mostly in northern Italy, but so Tuscany and whatnot. But and it's the main grape in Chianti. So when you see a bottle of Chianti, it's going to be mostly Sangiovese. So you could buy a bottle of Chianti. You can buy a California Sangiovese if you can find them, and I think those would also go very well. And with the zucchini, it really just depends on what you're putting in. So the little secret about pairing wine and food is a lot of times you're pairing wine with the sauce rather than the featured product. So, for example, you have chicken, which is, relatively mild in flavor. But if you have it with a sauce that, has lots of onion or caramelized onion and stock and all of that, you're probably going to want a red wine with that because it's going to have more flavor. But if you've made your chicken and you've got a little lemon and parsley on it, then you're probably going to want a white wine with that because, so you're not only are you pairing wine with the protein, but you're pairing it with the sauce. And usually the sauce flavor is what you're going to taste. So you go for that. So a lot of Italian fish dishes have tomatoes in them. So you normally don't necessarily serve red wine with fish, but in this case, you're pairing it with the sauce. So I'd serve a red wine with that. So those are a few hints. I mean, I can go on for hours and hours about pairing food and wine, but I think I'll put people to sleep. What I wanted
Or
to I
their probably mouths are all drooling just like mine.
want
Maybe you
Well,
should write a
good to
cookbook then if you don't want to do a
you know, I've
restaurant.
been thinking about that. I've been thinking about it because I've been putting so many recipes up on my blog for so long. So we'll see. But I wanted to just touch briefly on wine production and so we if we're eating organically grown food, we probably like to see if we can get organically produced wines too. And it's a little bit difficult. The USDA definition for organic in the United States is, you know, pretty much the same as it is for other agricultural products. But the problem is that they don't allow for the addition of sulfites into the wine. And sulfites are, you know, are something that have been used now for hundreds and hundreds of years in wine to preserve it. Because if you don't have sulfites in wine, you're going to get two things happening. One is oxidation. And you can tell that a wine is oxidized because it tastes like sherry. You know, if it smells and tastes like sherry and it's not supposed to, then your wine is oxidized. So it's been exposed to too much oxygen, even in the bottle. And it happens eventually, but it shouldn't happen quickly. And then the other thing is that wine can spoil and turn into vinegar. So the sulfites prevent the bacteria that turn alcohol into vinegar, and they also help protect the wine from the effects of too much oxygen. And they're in very small quantities. They've gotten a bum rap over the years because people believe that any time that they get a headache from red wine, it's because of the sulfites.
Right? I was going to ask, and is that a myth?
It's really not true. If you can eat dried apricots and not get a headache, then chances are you're eating a whole lot more sulfites than you're going to find in a bottle of wine. So it isn't the sulfites, but you know, it got that reputation. Now, this is not to say that some people aren't allergic to sulfites. And the reason that you have a label on the wine bottle that says contains sulfites is because some people have respiratory allergies, and you know, they'll get something akin to an asthma attack from consuming sulfites. And obviously you don't want that to happen. So anytime that a wine contains more than 10 parts per million sulfites, it has to be labeled contains sulfites. And sulfites occur naturally during the fermentation process, so all wine will contain some sulfites. But 10 parts per million is kind of the level that the FDA has determined won't harm people. So in order for a wine to be labeled as organic in the United States, not only does it have to meet all the standards of organic grape production, but there can't be added sulfites in the wine.
How do they add sulfites?
How do they add it?
Let's not worry about that.
No, it's in, you know, when they're aging the wine. So after fermentation takes about 2 weeks, something like that. After that, the wine gets put into storage tanks to age, or into barrels. And that's the point where they add the sulfites, you know. And again, very small amount. White wines tend to contain a little bit more sulfites than red wine because some of those compounds in the grape skins that we talked about before are also preservatives themselves. So red wine doesn't require as much sulfites as white wine does. But that's the point where they add them. And then, you know, they have to do a chemical analysis to determine how much sulfites are in there. There is an upper limit that's allowed. But if, as I said, if it has less than 10 parts per million of sulfites, they don't have to label it as contains sulfites. So organic wine in the U.S., wine that's labeled organic, USDA organic, has to not contain added sulfites, and the sulfite content has to be less than 10 parts per million. This leaves out almost every wine from Europe because they routinely add sulfites. They want their product to last. As I said, sulfites are not harmful to most people. And, you know, personally, if I'm paying $20 for a bottle of wine and I forget about it in my basement for a year, I don't want it to have spoiled. I want it to be drinkable. You know, there are plenty of people who are against adding sulfites. They think that it detracts from the natural character of the wine. And I respect their opinion on it, but I don't feel the same way. So when you get wine from Europe that's made under standards that would satisfy the grape growing part of USDA organic regulations, they're labeled made with organic grapes. They're not labeled organic wine. And
Oh,
that
okay.
comes that, yeah, so that the same thing occurs, for US producers too. If the grapes are grown organically, but the wine has added sulfites, it can be labeled made with organic grapes. And so it's a small distinction, but it's an important one, I think. I think that people should know that, first of all, I believe that the USDA organic rules need to be changed for organic wine. I think that sulfites in general, we're talking about naturally occurring sulfites added to wine. It's not some chemical that gets made from petroleum or anything like that. So I'm not sure what the issue is with that. The other thing that people might see is biodynamic wine. And biodynamic wine is by and large made like organic wine is made. There are some tenets of biodynamics that to the casual observer might seem a little odd, I think. For example, your winery should be oriented in, particular direction. There are things about lunar cycles in biodynamics. The thing that most people, I think, find funniest about biodynamics is that you're supposed to bury cow horns with manure in them. In your vineyards to help with the grape production. But what I like about biodynamics is that really it focuses on the health of the soil, and that healthy soil is going to make better grapes. And I think intrinsically people would agree that that makes sense, that you want healthier grapes. And that comes from healthier soil. Biodynamics allows the addition of sulfites.
Here, wait, hold on. Hey, green future growers. Don't forget to get your copy of the 2018 Organic Gardener Podcast, Garden Journal, and Data Keeper, available now at Amazon.com for $16.95. It's a place to keep track of your organic gardening journey, where you can record temperature, weather, recipes, produce that you grew, produce that you bought, and just all your successes and failures and challenges and dreams for the future, all your garden goals. Keep them track of them in one place. 225 pages that will go through each week of the year for the 2018 year. And just there's blank pages in there where you can sketch or write or do anything that will help you record your journey. So don't forget to get a copy of the 2018 Garden Journal and Data Keeper available at Amazon. You can go to the organicgardenerpodcast.com//2018 for the link. If you know somebody who would benefit from the Organic Gardener Podcast, we would just love it if you would share it with a friend. Thanks again for listening, and remember to grow.